on Saturday night. Sunday morning you don't look right. You've been out of painting the town. Uh-huh, baby, you've been slipping around. So, uh-uh, hey, honey, don't. Well,
you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Coming this Monday, September 8th at 2 p.m. on The Monday Sampler.
A man who came out to England in 1937, a refugee from Riga, name of Auric Goldfinger. In the summer of 1954, his trawler, homeward bound from India, went ashore on the Goodwins. The salvage company found traces in the hold of some sort of brown powder.
Gold?
Yes. The old fox had been precipitating his gold into this powder and shipping it to India as fertilizer. The gold squad couldn't pin it on him.
Toby Stevens, Sir Ian McKellen, and Rosamund Pike star in this 2010 BBC Radio 4 adaptation of Ian Fleming's popular 1959 novel, Goldfinger.
Mr. Goldfinger has £20 million worth of gold bars on safe deposit. I flew to Nassau and had a look at the £5 million worth he holds there in the vaults of the Royal Bank of Canada. Most of that gold belongs to England. We are asking you to bring Mr. Goldfinger to book, Commander Bond, and get it back. The quicker, the better.
So tune in this Monday, September 8th at 2 p.m. as the Monday Sampler presents part one of this radio adaptation of Ian Fleming's 1959 novel, Goldfinger. Right here on Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk, Portland Community College's broadcast about disability awareness. Let's Talk is a space for students from Portland Community College experiencing disabilities to discuss perspectives, ideas, and worldviews in an inclusive and accessible environment. We broadcast bi-weekly on our home website, pcc.edu/DCA, and bi-monthly right here on KBOO 90.7 FM. Today is the first Friday of the month, so we're coming to you live from KBOO studio. As a reminder, the views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the opinions or positions of Portland Community College, PCC Foundation, or KBOO FM. My name is Asher, and with me today is Mary, along with our special guest, Ira McKenzie, a student advocate from Portland Community College. Hi, Ira.
Hey, Asher. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And I'm going to give it over to Mary to talk about the scoop before we get into our questions.
Thank you, Asher. This is The Scoop, a rundown of things going on at PCC and the education sphere at large. September 12th is the Portland Fire and Rescue Portland Fire and Rescue versus Portland Police Bureau Charity Soccer Match, benefiting a selection of charities. Find more information online at portland.gov. The event will take place at Providence Park at 6 p.m. Go Dalmatians! Clackamas Community College President Tim Cook raised over $150,000 for students facing educational barriers by running all the way across Oregon. Covering 1,500 miles over 50 days, he visited more than 15 community colleges across the state as part of his journey. 2 weeks from the start of the PCC school year, applications are due by Wednesday of this next week, and don't miss your chance to sign up for your favorite non-credit art classes to enrich your life and build some community. Portland Community College has named Vicky Lopez Sanchez as their new permanent Vice President of Student Affairs after she spent this last year filling the interim position. Thank you, Vicky, and best of luck to you. High school football games in the Portland area will be without the familiar sound of marching bands this school year. The reason? Band directors of the Portland Interscholastic League are striking due to contract disputes involving out-of-classroom duties and pay, per Oregon Live. Whether or not this dispute will be resolved before the end of the football season is unknown. Some schools in the Portland area had early closure last week due to extreme heating concerns, with most of the buildings having insufficient or no air conditioning. The only schools with proper temperature control are the newly renovated and rebuilt buildings, while other schools have been moved further down the schedule due to budget concerns.
Thank you so much, Mary, for the scoop. Welcome once again, Ira. Thank you so much for taking the time to come talk to us. Just please tell us about yourself and what you do.
Yeah, thanks, Asher, and thanks, Mary. It's my pleasure to be here. So my name is Ira. As you said, my pronouns are they, them, theirs. And as a visual description for our listeners, I am a somewhat androgynous looking, I would say, non-binary person. White. I have shaggy blue hair and blue glasses. And if you ever see me out in the community, feel free to say hello and ask me about accessibility or disability culture or education in general. Mm-hmm. So about myself and what I do. So I noticed, actually, I just now noticed in the script, I swear I went over it before, that you said I'm a student advocate. Actually, I am a coordinator of student advocates.
Oh, my bad.
It's okay. You know, I could have caught that if I read it a little more closely.
Oh, it's okay.
But I'll that's okay. Now. You know, yeah. you're in the ballpark. You're in the ballpark. So that's totally fine. But yeah, I am the student advocate coordinator for the Office of Accessible Education and Disability Resources at Portland Community College. And generally, our office, Accessible Ed, as we call it, or AIDER, you'll hear us call it sometimes. We do the kind of standard, like accommodating students, supporting accessibility. But we also have a little arm of our department that focuses on disability culture, and that's where I'm seated. And my main job is to help coordinate and facilitate the work of students at PCC who work for our office as advocates of accessibility and disability culture.
So what does a student advocate do?
They do a lot of different things. it really is dependent on what the need is in the school, in the community, what the students identify as being most pressing or even most interesting to them. I mean, hopefully it's interesting to them, right? We usually ask students to focus on whatever interests them, what drives them, what they're passionate about, because the core of the focus of student advocacy is student voice and bringing that into the processes of the college.
Nice. Very nice. How did you get started in advocacy?
Oh, gee. It's kind of a long story. To make it really short, I got started in advocacy as a student myself when I was about maybe 12 or 13 years old.
Wow.
In our neighbors to the north, Vancouver, Washington, not BC, America's Vancouver, as you might call it.
Vantucky.
Sure. Yeah. When I was a kid, some people would sort of semi-ironically refer to it as the Couve. I don't think anyone appreciates that nickname. It's
How so?
I don't know why exactly. It's kind of silly. I think it's sort of like people in San Francisco don't like it when you call it Frisco. They're like, it's San Francisco, San Fran, or nothing. Thank you very much.
Okay. But, well.
At any rate, up in Vancouver, they have a board of county commissioners, or at least they did when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And so they have this organization called the Clark County Youth Commission, which is, I think, about 30 youth from all across Clark County, which is actually quite a large area if you were not familiar. And they come together each year to work with the Clark County Board of County Commissioners. So they're like sort of a semi-governmental agency. Anyways, each year they ask them, hey, we want to hear youth voice on this issue, whatever the issue might be, whatever is relevant that year. And then the youth commissioners look at that, and they spend the whole year researching it, collecting youth voice, doing focus groups, doing surveys, doing events. And then they submit a report to the Board of County Commissioners. So I started there through high school into early college. In college, I got into what you would call like student advocacy, working in student government. Bounced around everywhere, went through like two different programs, like degree programs, didn't like either of them. Ended up back at PCC as a student working in the queer resource centers because I was like, well, my background is student advocacy. I might as well do a job while I'm incurring all this debt to figure out what I want to do with my life. And my boss said, hey, you know, you could do this kind of work professionally, right? And I was like, what? And they were like, yeah, you could go get a master's degree and focus on student student life and student affairs. So I did. And to keep a long story short, eventually I ended up in this position a couple years ago.
Nice. Nice. That's super cool.
Yeah.
What is the QRC for people who aren't affiliated with BCC? What do they do there?
Yeah, the Queer Resource Center is one of, oh gosh, is it like half a dozen different student resource centers at PCC? They call them, I think they call them identity-based equity centers. But at any rate, they're places that focus on student life and student culture through the lens of specific student identity groups. Typically, in the literature, you'd call them like historically marginalized or historically underserved student groups. That being said, all of those centers are open to all students. Any student can go in them. Their programming and events and focus is just situated around a general, like a particular student identity. So Career Resource Center focuses on LGBTQIA plus students. Veterans Resource Center focuses on veterans. Multicultural Center focuses on students of color. Women's Resource Center focuses on women-identified students. And there's also the Dreamers Center for documented and undocumented immigrant students. And then there are sundry others: student life, student engagement, sustainability, student leadership, student government, civic leadership. There's a lot of different student-focused areas at BCC.
Do you still work with any of those directly?
Directly and indirectly. A lot of our work is about collaboration. So a student voice is the core of it, but that means necessarily working with other areas that focus on different types of student voice. And the interesting thing about disability is twofold. So one is that disability is the only minority group that anyone can enter at any time. So you could live your whole life and have an accident and become disabled. You could, you know, grow up and have an average childhood, get sick, become disabled. You could, it's a wide variety of things, right? And not to pigeonhole it in any way. The other thing is that disability intersects necessarily then with every other type of identity, and not just marginalized identities, all identities, any type of person and any type of group, across history, across time, across any political affiliation, gender, sexuality, nationality, anything, can have a disability or identify as having a disability. So yeah, we do. Long story short, we work with all the different centers as much as we can and as much as they, you know, depends on their capacity and do they want to work with us and where do our interests intersect and what does everybody have time for and things like that.
Okay. Yeah, lots of intersectionality between all those different groups at PCC.
Yeah, well, there's always a possibility for any of them to intersect. And we're always working to increase like our programming and our efficacy in how we serve intersecting identities. You know, ones that relate to or connected to or just happen to intersect with with disability, whatever it might be.
Awesome.
Very good. Cool. I know you talked about this a little bit, but because school started off with for everybody at this point. So we want to know, what should students know about student advocacy and how does it help students, I would say?
Yeah, so it's kind of a complicated question. Like, what is student advocacy? There's the long answer and the short answer. The short answer is student advocacy is about bringing student voice and student power into the higher education milieu, if you want to call it that. Student advocacy is really about, like, what can students do to make the changes that they want to see in the higher education environment? And it's really, like, anywhere there are students, there can be student advocacy, but we're focused on higher education right now, because that's what where we're at. And it does look a little bit different depending on K-12 or higher ed or other types of student organizations and activities out there in the world. But what students should know about it is that you don't have to work with a specific department or be hired in a specific position or even be in an organization to do student advocacy. Student advocacy is really about a student, any given student who wants to advocate for change, large or small, in the short term or in the long term, whatever it might be. Now, how you do that, strategies, who you work with, how you get these things accomplished is a different conversation, but at its core, student advocacy is about a student advocating.
Which I think is hard for a lot of people, because especially in education, you're taught to keep your head down, be quiet, do the work on the board, do the worksheet, fill out all the little scantrons. And for a lot of people, that's easy, and for a lot of people, it's hard, bordering on impossible. And a lot of the system has been designed to shut down individuals and their voices and their needs. So having student advocates is a very important thing for people to be able to progress in their own education.
Certainly.
And supporting students' abilities to advocate for themselves.
I would agree with that. I would say your standard education here in the United States is focused on, I mean, ostensibly it's focused on education, right? But what does it serve to do? Oftentimes it serves to teach people how to work, and not in terms of like, oh, we'll get you a good job. We'll get you into a trade. Like, we'll teach you a job. It's not about that. It's about going to work, the 9-to-5, the grind, the willingness to submit to authority, to do what you have to do to complete your job on a daily basis and show up the next day. So you see things like large focus on homework, on deadlines, on daily schedules, on things like that. And that doesn't necessarily lend itself to advocacy. And it also, especially, you know, self-advocacy, but definitely not group advocacy, community organizing, things like that, because also within the context of U.S. education, we have a strongly individualized approach to education, and it creates a lot of problems. There's also the problem of which group, which background do you come from, and this sort of a double standard depending on what sort of group you come from. So in an individualistic society like the U.S., if you come from a dominant cultural group, then you're more likely to be able to run by that rule of like the squeaky wheel gets the grease. You know, if you stand up and say something, and especially if it aligns with the general ideals or ambitions of the administration, you're more likely to see results from your efforts. If you belong to a marginalized or historically underrepresented group and you try to stand up and make changes, you're more likely to end up in a situation where it's like the nail that stands up gets hammered down. And so there are different needs for advocacy. Not that dominant group folks can't advocate, not that they never have anything good to advocate for. I'm not saying that at all. But it's more like different groups have different reasons to advocate. They have different strategies for advocacy, and they have different end results depending on how much they're advocacy and their goals align with the institutions that they're working within.
Absolutely. You're listening to Let's Talk, Portland Community College's broadcast about disability culture and awareness on KBOO FM. So you mentioned that there is an individualistic approach to education in the U.S. What do you mean by that?
Our educational system exists within the system of our culture, and that's kind of an esoteric way of saying, like, we do things because this is how we do them, right? Mm-hmm. Here in the U.S., we're an individualistic society as compared to other cultures, which may be categorized as collectivistic, right? Mm-hmm. And what that really means is that the individual's needs and desires and goals are placed at the forefront, whereas compared to collectivist societies, the needs and desires of the group is placed ahead of the individual. So that creates problems on both sides, not that one is better than the other. In an individualistic society, it makes it very hard for people to work together as groups because people are focused on their own individual needs and wants. In a collectivist society, it makes it difficult, where if you want something different than the group, it might be very hard to. And I kind of highlighted that a little bit. It was like a little preview in my previous comments about, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease versus the nail that stands out gets hammered down. Squeaky wheel gets the grease is an individualistic perspective, kind of idiomatic saying. The nail that stands out gets hammered down comes from collectivist societies where, you know, you don't want to stand out because you're going to get pushback.
Thank you.
Yeah, that is hard. I totally agree with what you were saying just now, Miri, of like it's difficult for a lot of students to advocate for themselves, and there's that whole, well, I wouldn't say it's a culture, whole idea of just like having your head down and doing the work, doing the check marks, and like making sure that everything, all your ducks are in a row and stuff. With that in mind, just how can instructors advocate for students, or how can they help them to, if they're like going through difficulties and they need help but don't necessarily I'm not sure how to say it, is like brave enough to reach out for help, something like that.
I might want to back up a little bit to this, like the sub question of like how does advocacy help students. It helps them in terms of like you don't really want other people to be speaking on your behalf unless you're closely in community with them and they understand, like truly deeply understand your needs and your desires. In that case, it may be helpful for someone to speak on your behalf because they may have more power or know the right people or be in the right position to say something and have it be heard, which is really what is, what's really difficult about advocacy is not just the speaking up, but the being heard. It's why a lot of people struggle to stay in advocacy spaces because
a lot of burnout and turnover.
Burnout, turnover. People don't we tend to think, especially because we're in an individualistic society which has this these ideals of the strong man, the American dream, things like that, where it's like, if I just work hard enough, I will get what I want. I will get what I need. If I just shout loud enough, people will hear me. And that doesn't happen. And it is incredibly depressing.
People get, very much so.
People get really upset and burnt out. And so while I do advocate, I advocate for students to advocate for themselves. I support them, I think would be a better way to say it. I support students in their advocacy, and I do that by not just me, but my type of position, a student coordinator, does that by supporting student leadership, by training students in how to advocate, how to make connections, also in how to see systems and where they fit within those systems. Because a school is a system. It's built in a certain way, right? And it exists within our local system, the Pacific Northwest, the culture of our area, right? Which is fits within the American system, which fits within the global system. So anyways, it's kind of like turtles all the way down, you might say. At any rate, go ahead.
And I think the position that you are in, that you have, also increases a student's ability to be heard while advocating for themselves. Because if it is just one student or a group of students who are coming together unofficially and saying these things, it's much easier for an administration or whatever group that they are talking to ignore them than if there is a created job position like yours that specifically calls for that to be a thing that they want people to do and forces them to listen to it.
Right. The institutional power of being an employee in a certain type of position lends itself to getting your foot in the door in certain ways. And it's definitely helpful as well. Not just in terms of maybe people don't want to listen to you because they're against everything you want to do. But more just like, would you really want to take up like a cold pitch from someone you'd never heard of, never met, don't know what they do, right? Or would you rather like have a friend tell you, hey, I have a friend who has a great idea. We should like, let's talk about it. Maybe we could do something with this idea, right? It can, it lends itself to actually making any kind of progress. But to your question, Asher, is like, this is, there's a double side to it, right? Because you wouldn't have students if you didn't have faculty and staff. You wouldn't have faculty and staff if you didn't have students. So yes, faculty and staff can advocate for students. They should advocate for students. And they work together in tandem. Faculty and staff who are fighting for the rights of students or the, to support students are going to find it hard to justify that if there are no students working with them saying, yeah, we want this. And students are going to find it hard to advocate for what they want if they have no faculty and staff saying, yes, we see a need for this. So they work together in tandem. They should work best together when they work together. So what instructors can actually do, and not just instructors, but staff too, people who are in my kind of position, working in what they call student life or student affairs, right? The best thing they can do is, yes, they can advocate for students. But that's like the next step. The first step is creating an inclusive and welcoming and supportive environment for all students, regardless of what background they come from, what they need. And that doesn't necessitate, like, you do need to learn about these students and what they might need, right? But there are, like, some general rules of thumb. If we're talking about disability, that's universal design. That's universal design for education or learning, universal design for learning, whatever you might want to call it. And that looks like – it looks like a lot of things. People always want specific answers. What can I do? Specifically, what can I do? And it's like, well, if you want me to tell you specifically what to do, then you're going to need to give me a scenario because there's a million and one things you could do. And it really depends on your situation. And so to speak more broadly, right, then you can't be so specific. You have to be broad. And broadly speaking, universal design looks like evaluating and questioning the systems that are in place as they are. And even that necessitates that you already believe, at least to some degree, that the things, the way things are now, are not working as effectively as they could. So it's going to be hard for you to implement changes if you feel like there are no changes that need to be made.
And I think that point of people asking what can I specifically do lends to what you were saying about individualist versus collectivist thought, where someone's like, oh, well, there obviously must be one thing, one individual thing that I, the individual, must change to make this make this easier. And it's like, well, I mean, yes and no. There's like 35 things that you can change a little bit, but also, you know, the class next door to you has to also change 35 things, and they have to change, you know, 70 things above you. And
Yes and no, right? Because depending on your position as a teacher, an adjunct is going to find it hard to make a lot of different changes, but they still have some degree of, like, when they're in the classroom, classroom time, in those lecture hours, they can make individual changes that may make the experience better for students in that class at that time. But this is so hard. What I was going to say is, like, if you want to know specifically what can I do, you want one takeaway that anybody can do at any time with any position, any resources across time, is literally just listen to people with disabilities. Listen to them. And I mean, don't just open your ear holes and allow like sound to come in. Don't just open your eyeballs and allow signs to come in, right? Literally engage, honestly, openly, compassionately with what a person is telling you when they're telling you, I have a disabled experience, mm-hmm. and this is how it impacts me. Mm-hmm. And that's across the board in any person, any, hey, listeners out there, you don't have to be in higher education, right? In any walk of life, in your family, in your community, in your schools, in your churches, in your freaking little league, whatever, I don't know. Uh-huh. Just listen to other people when they tell you they have an experience, and err on the side of believing them, right? I guess if you are a skeptical kind of person, you can take an approach of trust but verify, right? Mm-hmm. Since we're talking about higher education, what instructors and other staff and faculty can do, bare minimum, specifically what they can do, is listen to students with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's always an uphill battle for them, because a lot of times the person they're talking to is like, oh, well, you're just complaining. You're just a complainer.
Right.
Yeah. This isn't a problem for anyone else. Why do you have to make it a problem?
Making a problem. It's like, well,
because this is the one person who's trying to take your class in a wheelchair at the top of the stairs. Like, it's not going to be a problem for anyone else. So
right.
They wouldn't even think of it.
Yeah.
It speaks to, it kind of is connected to concepts of like we see in feminism with victim blaming and not believing women when they talk about their experiences with harassment or assault or domestic violence or things like that. And, not that it's always so serious, a life and death kind of threat thing, mm-hmm. but rather just like these ideas of like, you're just complaining. What is it? What is that common thing that people say? You're just looking for attention.
Yeah.
It's like,
they're all, yeah.
Have we ever considered that maybe if someone is looking for attention, it's because they need attention?
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no.
Maybe they just need some attention. Maybe they need to connect. Maybe they need to be heard.
In the U.S. and the Western world at large, and I think just all of Earth at large, we think of attention as like this greedy, selfish
thing,
unimportant thing that, you know, is a childish want and a childish need. Mm. But it is a fundamental thing that every person needs. Like, if you don't get any attention,
right,
you go crazy. You are miserable. Attention is an important thing, both like individual one-on-one attention, one-on-two attention, and attention within a group.
Yeah.
Right. It's kind of a educational theory type thing. We don't have to get into the weeds of it. But most people have heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? And at the tippy top of that pyramid is self-actualization. And it's similar for higher education or any type of education, really, where you got to start with safety needs, biological, physical needs, and then you have community needs and efficacy needs, feeling like what you do is actually affects something. And then you can get to things like self-actualization. And if you're not, if you are not currently doing a master's degree in higher education, it probably is not that interesting to you, but it's deeply important to the kind of work that I do, which is like, school is not just school. College is not just college. It's not just classes, right? Mm-hmm. College is a collection of experiences that students have. And when you come to college, you do more than just seek to complete a degree. You make connections, you learn, you grow as a person. You have the opportunity, in theory, to do those things. Mm-hmm. But if your basic needs, like your housing and food and shelter needs, and then a little bit above that, your feeling of belonging, your feeling of well-being, of engagement with the school, if those are not being met, then you do not get to take advantage of those opportunities to learn and to grow and become the best person that you can be, not just student, but person.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Absolutely. You're listening to Let's Talk, Portland Community College's broadcast about disability culture and awareness on KBOO FM.
Cool. What are the most common challenges you see students come up against, and what are some ways for them to get around and over it? Yeah.
Well, I feel like a broken record being like, well, it's complicated. Well, there's a lot of answers. Well.
Yeah.
Things about education and interpersonal relationships are complicated.
Yeah. Please school us.
I don't have a master's degree. I'm learning.
I'm learning too.
I think the most common issues are those where people are not being listened to and not being taken seriously. And so you might think that the answer to that is, well, just talk louder, be more assertive, be more aggressive, be a force that cannot be ignored. And not that those are wrong or bad options, but on an individual level, they don't tend to get people very far.
No.
Your best options are to find coalitions, to find people that will help you, to find allies and supporters within the school. And honestly, that's why we have departments like Accessible Education and Disability Resources, because they exist to be that voice for the students at an institutional level. But in terms of what are the most common things, like to give you a more concrete answer, like the most common challenges that students come up against really are things like needing extended testing time, needing flexible deadlines, needing the ability to take care of their own like body needs and sensory needs in classes. Like a lot of instructors just off the rip, for example, would be like, no headphones, no sunglasses, no hoods. And people might ask like, well, how are you gonna learn if you have headphones in? How are you gonna learn if you have sunglasses or a hood on, right? And it's like, well, maybe you could, instead of being weird about it, you could just ask the student, hey, is this helping you in some way? Does this serve you in some way? And you could believe them when they tell you, like, when I get outside noises coming into my ears, I really get distracted, so the headphones help as a noise buffer for me. Or when the light is shining in my eyeballs, these harsh fluorescent lights, I can't focus, I can't see anything, I can't, you know, be engaged. When I have to sit here and sit still for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours at a time with minimal breaks, my body feels like it's gonna explode, and so I need to move, right? But we have very rote ideas about how students should or shouldn't act in a classroom. And so
very much so.
When people try to go outside of that, it almost seems like a kind of an affront to an instructor, because instructors also exist. Not that instructors are bad people. I mean, I'm sure some of them are individually, right? Every person is.
Rate my instructor.
I had a physics teacher once at a school who said directly one time in class, oh, yeah, I stopped caring about students like 10 years ago.
What? I was
like, oh, my God.
No.
Man, is that why literally everyone is failing this class?
So, you know, instructors are people, too. So some of them are good. Some of them are bad, right? Not that they're ontologically evil or whatever, but they're just some people are just like any other job in the world. Some people are good at their job. Some people are not. Some people are nice. Some people are mean. But broadly speaking, instructors are just people that want to do a good job. I mean, education is not
easy.
It's not easy, and it's not a prestige position most of the time. Maybe the top half of 1% are people, academics, that your average person might say, like, oh, I know who that is.
Yeah.
Or I've read their book, or I like their podcast, or whatever. But your average person, especially working at a community college, even if it's the biggest one in the region, like, it's not a prestige position. So people go into education because they care about educating. Gasp. You know what I mean? Might seem crazy, but so at any rate, you originally asked me, like, what are some common things students struggle with? And it really just comes back to whatever it is a student is struggling with. If a professor can address it directly, then use that rule of thumb that I shared earlier. Just listen. Just listen and try your best. If if the professor can't address it or is unwilling to, the student should work with their Office of Accessibility. Mm. A lot of places it's called Disability Services or Disability Resources. Mm. And there is, at the end of the day, like a legal system, mm-hmm. Legal compliance that the school must follow, whether they make that easy or hard on the student or on faculty, staff, whatever, is a different question. I mean, I know I can speak for PCC and say we do, in my estimation, we do a really good job of moving beyond this medical legal compliance model sort of cookie cutter one size fits all. If you have this disability, you get this accommodation. We work really hard to move beyond that. Some people see us as a leader in certain areas of accessibility in terms of higher education, especially in digital accessibility. So there's a lot folks can do, and it's just like, where are you at? Who are you working with? Who do you want to work with? Mm-hmm. What level are they at? Who do they know? What kind of connections can you make?
Yeah, I know a lot of people who have come to PCC and been like, wow, we got things, I got something taken care of that I needed taken care of that, you know, this school, that school, other school, high school, never could.
Never
right.
Did.
Or mm-hmm. just completely ignored it or didn't have the infrastructure to support it.
Yeah.
Which leads into my next question, which is what kinds of things can be covered by individual advocacy and what kinds of changes need to be made at just higher levels? Like what can be done student to instructor versus what needs to be done student coalition versus school coalition, government coalition, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a good question.
'Cause like a teacher can't install a ramp. And a school can't approve state budget for a ramp and so forth.
You know, we could probably spend an entire hour just talking about strategies and how they differ between the different levels within higher education. I would say at the individual level, what people can do, again, is talk and listen. Students can, as unfair as it is, right? When you present yourself in a certain way, you're more likely to have people talk to you. So students can try to present themselves in a quote-unquote respectable way. For some people, that's just not possible. Some people can't mask their disability or pretend that it's something else. Some people can't mask their other aspects of their identity that are necessarily...
looked on unfavorably.
Yeah.
Just unconsciously even.
Even unconsciously, yeah.
Because like if you're super poor and you are just wearing the same shirt that you've had for the last, you know, 6 years since high school or whatever.
Yeah.
Versus if you can afford to get even a nice like a you know, Amazon button up shirt.
Right.
which some people can't because, you know, that'll be $30-$40 that just don't have the option to spend.
Yeah.
And one of those is just going to be inherently taken more seriously at a town hall type thing.
Right.
Just because of how everything is set up.
Yeah.
It's so that's kind of the difficulty is like, what can people do at what level? Where do certain things matter? I don't want to perpetuate this idea that you have to look a certain way or act a certain way to get things that you want. So broader. And it also depends on where is your position, where are you coming from, what are you advocating for, like from whom to whom, right? Like from a place to another place, another organization, from one level to another. But broadly speaking, at the individual level, you can communicate. If you're able to present yourself in a more presentable fashion, cool, that's great. That might be helpful, not that it's fair. Mm-hmm. But at the core level, it's communicate. If you have a need, share it. Right? Mm-hmm. Be earnest, be open, be willing to communicate that to someone. If you're in a position to listen, try to listen, communicate back.
Yeah.
Communicate back what you can and can't do or what you believe you can and can't do. Mm-hmm. At the institutional level, it's really about, it's still about communication, right? At the end of the day, nothing happens if people don't communicate and work together. But it, more broadly, it's about capacity, which is a word you'll hear a lot in, especially in student affairs and in organizational theory and things like that. But capacity is this concept of like, what can we do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and your capacity depends on what people believe is possible and what people are willing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So at the institutional level, it's really about who wants to do something, who's willing to make it happen,
uh-huh.
what do they believe is possible, what do they believe they can reasonably get done, who has the time, who has the energy, who has the connections. And so there's mm-hmm. never any really easy answer, but I guess what people can do is show up, right?
Yeah.
If you have a college-wide level issue that you want to bring up or try to make a change with, you start at your level. You talk to other people. If you're an instructor, you talk to other instructors. If you're a staff, you talk to other staff.
Mm-hmm.
You figure out who else cares about this thing. Then you bring it up to the manager level. You try to get a bead on, like, what do the managers think about it? What are they aware of? What do they think is possible? And not to trash managers or anything like that, but they have different priorities than the people mm-hmm. that are working your average laborer, right?
Yeah.
Managers serve to help the institution run. And so they have goals and preferences that tend to more often align with the institution. And
mm-hmm.
individuals tend to have more individual-based needs, wants. They're on the ground. They can see what needs to change more readily. They have a faster reaction time
mm-hmm.
To different problems. And so they're, like I was saying earlier, their views and ideas may not align with the institution and what people think is, everybody at different levels has different perspectives, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's not just about what you think is possible, but what can you convince others in terms of what is possible? Something you think is totally reasonable, like, hey, let's allow people to extend testing times without pulling teeth over it, right?
You might go
to an administrator and they'll say, oh, absolutely not. We mm-hmm. cannot extend testing times without having full documentation of a relevant disability because, mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, a lot of the times it's because this is how we do it,
yeah.
right? They don't necessarily have... Well, we won't get into that, but at any rate.
It is a very, I mean, everything is very, why are we doing it this way? Oh, because this is how we do it.
Yeah.
And
people are not, that almost sounds kind of like absurd,
mm.
almost kind of like cartoonishly evil. Like,
yeah. like why?
Really, you have no justification? Usually people do have justifications.
Yes.
But whether they are... whether they make sense to your average person is different, or to faculty, staff, right? If management says, like, we must do this because of institutional effectiveness, it's like, okay, as a faculty, staff, you're like, what does that mean? Effective mm-hmm. for who? Within yep. this institution or within an institution of power that we're replicating here within the college?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these rules were made in every organization in the past when just yeah. common sense was different, like
yeah.
when
right.
priority, cultural and individual priorities were different, when systems of power, like you mentioned, were being more intentionally rigidly enforced and set up.
Right.
So that's when that, you know, this decision was made. You only have 55 minutes for this test, and otherwise
right.
we cut your leg off.
Right.
Cut your leg off.
Because that's the very military tradition. That's the very classic right. Americana
time.
Tradition.
Goodness.
And as time's gone on, then we're much more interested in culturally the student's perspective and people who need more time, who can do just as well on a test, but
yeah.
it'll take them 90 minutes, not 55
yeah.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what I'm talking about, it falls under what's called student development theory, and
yeah.
it's really only grown as an area of study in like the last 100 years.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
It's really new. And also, it's very American. Like the way, people might be really surprised, but like clubs, athletic groups, sororities, fraternities, student event programming, all of those things that we call student life, it's almost uniquely American. Like, they don't necessarily do it that way in other countries. And so it's really fascinating. And to my previous points about, you know, people versus institutions, people versus management, things like that, it's not really necessarily talking about PCC. You know, I'm definitely not trying to trash PCC or anything like that. I'm speaking more broadly at an institutional level.
No, definitely.
Any school you go to, unless it's, I don't know, the exception to the rule, right? The general rule is like, this is the academy. The academy is structured in a certain way, and it's run a certain way, and it exists within our culture, which is structured a certain way and is run a certain way. And so you're going to find these problems at all schools anywhere through across time. And to our credit at PCC, I think we do a pretty good job of listening to students and working together with faculty and staff. Always room for improvement, right? Nobody's ever going to be perfect, but I went here as a student. I work here as a staff now. Yeah. I think we definitely do better than other schools that I've gone to, and I've been at several different schools and worked at several different schools.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, to that point, right? Like, for example, I was talking earlier about how schools can go above and beyond the medical legal model of compliance with accommodations, right? And here at PCC, our philosophy when we approach accommodations for students, and this is when students request formal accommodations, right? Because instructors can do a lot in their classes with universal design and an eye for accessibility to alleviate the need for formal accommodations. But when students look for accommodations, they say, I need help, I need support, right? We take an approach of like, if you want to have a conversation with us about the kind of supports you need, you don't need to prove that you're disabled. This is really not the case at a lot of colleges. A lot of colleges, it's changing slowly a little bit over time, but a lot of colleges, like, you cannot even get in the door at a disability services office if you don't have medical documentation of a disability, right?
Yeah. And not just colleges, but like, I mean, public schools and jobs and other stuff.
Yeah. No, you're right. Totally. Yeah. Getting accommodations is typically seen as a legal process that complies with medical proof of a disability. But in terms of higher education, and this is like going back to this earlier question of like, what common problems do you see with students is the fact is two things. The fact that they don't know at PCC, when they're coming into PCC, they don't know that they do not have to prove their disability just to talk to us. Now, this doesn't mean we give out accommodations willy-nilly and throw accessible tech at every student that we see, right? But it means that you don't have to prove yourself just to talk to us. And for certain things, if it's reasonable, like, okay, it's in your file, you can have this accommodation, you just indicate if you need it for a given class and a given term, whatever. Other things, it's like, yeah, we need some proof of this because it's complicated, but so it's not across the board. Every single disability will be accommodated. No questions asked, no proof needed. To have a conversation with us and to start that collaborative process of getting some accommodations and supports, you don't need to walk in the door with a doctor's note. And a lot of students do not know that, and they think, they don't come to us because they think, I'm not going to qualify. And that's just not true.
I've never been formally diagnosed with ADHD, so I guess I'll just, you know, torture myself through this academic year.
And the thing
that's a big one.
Thing is, at least with PCC, I don't know how it is at other schools, you know, we have some options and some opportunities to help students get diagnostic services or evaluations. Not across the board, not all the time, not in every situation, right? Because it costs money, right? There's limited funds. And it's also complicated, like we look at things like, you know, would you otherwise be able to get this without our help? Like, well, then you should probably go do that, right?
Yeah, because for low vision students with the, the magnification system? I don't remember what it's called. I was just Googling this like the other week. Or people who need interpreters. Like, those are things that are very expensive and very hard to get on your own.
Right.
Right.
Or like my boss was telling me the other day, like certain copyrighted works, right? If a student needs them in an alternative format, like a company,
I hadn't even thought of that.
A company will give you that alt format, right? But you to be able to reasonably justify like why you did it. And so then we might ask, okay, do you have like, you have an eye, what is it called? Like a thing that says that you're legally blind,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Can you, can we, so that we could reasonably justify it to someone if someone came and said like, hey, you're giving this out for free. Like, why are you doing this? Like, who said, like,
yeah.
Where is that blind person that you gave this to, right? Like, are they really blind? But the other thing that a lot of students don't know is that the system works differently than K through 12. To make it really simple, K through 12, your parents and the school are typically the ones that are deciding what your education plan is going to be if you have a disability. Mm-hmm. And if they notice that you have problems, they'll note that, and then they'll start a process of getting accommodations for you in a perfect world. A lot of students don't.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't, that doesn't happen.
Through failing of one of those parties or another.
Right. But the idea is, if a student is identified as needing support, the school and the parents and the teachers will work together to create what's called an individualized education plan or a 504 plan, something like that. And it may or may not have input from the student, but broadly it's going to be the school and the teachers and the parents that put it in place. But anyway, that's just not how it works at the college level. At the college level, you have to advocate for yourself. If you need something, you have to reach out and ask for it or get referred for it. But even then, the referral is like someone telling you, hey, I think you would benefit from these services. You should talk to this person, right? So students don't always know they have to do that process themselves, and they don't always know that at PCC specifically, that you do not need to prove yourself just to get in the door and have that conversation. And so a lot of students self-select themselves out of the process of getting accommodations.
Especially coming from, you know, if you go here straight after high school, then you will have gone from an IEP plan for the last 12 years of your life to now you take care of it yourself.
Yeah.
Right. Or people may have issues where the school they went to, K-12, was good enough in terms of supports that they didn't need formal accommodation. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they were, let's say, gifted enough or effective enough in their schooling that it wasn't that hard for them, whatever they needed to do. It wasn't that hard. Then they get into college, and it's a whole different animal where everything is self-directed, everything is self-scheduled. And they're like, oh, I can barely function in this organization of education, in this style of education. Now I really need support, and I don't know how to get it.
Yeah, because it's a huge shock for people without any sort of disability, let alone if there is something that is giving you an extra barrier that you have to then push through.
For sure.
And that's not to say every student with a disability is going to struggle in college, right?
Certain
disabilities lend themselves to working, focusing on certain things over time or intensely. You know, people who are able to hyper focus, if they're learning something they're interested in, they can do extremely well with that, with limited support. And so is this, that's not to paint all disabled students as like ineffectual or constantly needing help, but just that it's very individualistic. People may need help here, but not here. They need it now, but not then.
And it's always important for them to have some sort of support, some sort of support in case there is, in case they crash or they have burnout or something comes up in their life.
Yes.
And that is something that everyone needs. Everyone needs that, you know, whether whether you have autism or a mobility impairment, or if you are just neurotypical, able-bodied, etc.
Yeah,
there should be some sort of safety net for you to rely on if things get hard.
Yeah,
right.
Or default to. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. So
we're gonna get into closing questions.
Yeah.
You want to do it or?
So okay. To alleviate some of the heavy talk.
The heavy talk, yes.
If you could go anywhere in the world for vacation, where would it be? Say you get 2 weeks there.
2 weeks.
2 weeks. 2 weeks.
Yeah. This is such a hard question.
hardest one. Yeah, I'm giving you the real fastball up in the zone.
I like a lot of different cultures. I've studied a lot of different languages. I probably would have to go back to Japan.
Oh, Japan's nice.
I've been there before. I had a really bad time because of my disability. It was like undiagnosed at the time. And so I was like, well, why am I freaking out? So now that I'm an adult and I have a better grasp on that, I think I'd have a lot better time there. But not that I had the worst time ever, just it was suboptimal.
It wasn't what you wanted. It wasn't what you were looking for.
But yes, I would go back to Japan and spend more time traveling around Japan because I stayed in Tokyo at the time. Nice. And school, I mean, there's a lot to do in Tokyo, but there's also other, I mean,
biggest city in the world.
Yes. Whole archipelago they got over there.
I know, right?
This is more than just Tokyo over there.
All those northern, southern islands. Yeah, that would be pretty cool. So yeah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah.
And for
no problem.
Sharing your incredible depth of knowledge and experience. So yeah, thank you very much for joining us. And thank you, listeners, for listening to Let's Talk, Portland Community College's broadcast about disability culture. Find more information and resources concerning this episode and others at pcc.edu/DCA. You can also find linked resources on today's episode page, hosted on kbu.fm, search for Let's Talk. This episode was produced by the Let's Talk Podcast Collective as a collaborative effort between students, the Accessible Education and Disability Resources Department, the PCC Multimedia Department, and KBOO. We post newly recorded content bi-weekly on our home website. Again, that's pcc.edu/DCA, and we hope you always tune into our shows here on KBOO, every first and third Friday of the month at 11 a.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.